Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ned Jankel. I represent the defendant appellant in this matter, Ramon Lopez. I'm going to devote most of my time, perhaps all of my time, to the first issue raised in the opening brief, and that concerns the insufficiency of the evidence here to establish the Class 1 felony of extreme indifference murder. And then if there's time left over, I'd also like to discuss issue number 2, which concerns the court's failure to give responsive answers to a series of jury questions, which I think can be fairly characterized as how do we fill out these verdict forms if we want to enter a conviction for the lesser offense of second-degree murder. Although neither issue is dependent on the other, I think there's sort of an interesting connection here because the element that is in fact missing from the conviction for extreme indifference murder is the very element that distinguishes that crime from second-degree murder. I begin with a very basic premise, and that is that a conviction cannot stand if the evidence is insufficient to establish any one of the elements of the offense. If it's possible for that basic premise to have any more significance, it would be in the case of extreme indifference murder, because the very element that is missing here is the only element that distinguishes it from the lesser included offense of second degree murder. We know that, and we know that from the series of cases by the Colorado Supreme Court, beginning with Marcy, following with Jefferson, and then with People v. Candelaria. We know that, but for that element, that second-degree murder is indistinguishable from extreme indifference murder, and that to punish someone with the elevated penalty of a Class 1 felony, life without parole, would violate the Colorado Constitution's equal protection provision and our notions of due process. So if we look back then at Marcy, we know then at that time the Supreme Court held that the offense as it was drafted then is semantically indistinguishable from second-degree murder. It at that time had an element requiring circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to human life. Following that, of course, the statute was amended, and a split Supreme Court held that adding, changing up that language to then read that the killing act must occur under circumstances evincing universal malice and extreme indifference to human life generally, that at least five of the justices of the Supreme Court agreed that was a significant enough change, that was a meaningful semantic distinction between the first and the second, and therefore the statute now comported with our notions of equal protection, our notions of due process. So I think it follows from that that element must have, that there must be evidence to support that element, and that element must have a real and tangible meaning. It must mean that the killing act is by its very nature, in the circumstances of its commission, evinces a willingness to take human life indiscriminately without knowing or caring who the victim may be. And I would submit to this court that that cannot be the case in this case. That cannot be the case here, where the evidence shows that, suggests that Mr. Lopez points out four people in a bar who are associated with Mr. Escobal, the ultimate victim in this case, as members of a rival gang, the Oldies gang. The evidence.
But he apparently, Mr. Jacob, excuse me for interrupting, sir, but he apparently didn't even know the other three men. He knew, or at least he thought he knew that he was a member of the Oldies gang and flashed his gang sign at him. But as far as the other three fellows went, he didn't know them from Adam.
Well, I believe what the evidence shows, and there's a dispute over the theory of the case and the motivation behind it. The defense counsel suggested that raising the shirt was to show that he wasn't, didn't have a wire, wasn't an undercover agent, that this was all related to some sort of drug transaction or something. But it's true, what you say, Judge Graham, that he only encountered Norman Escobal. But it's also true, according to Mr. Segura, that he points out the entire party of the entire Escobal party and where they're seated in the bar when Mr. Segura arrives at the bar. It's also true that he allegedly, according to Mr. Segura, tells him, we want to dump on, shoot at, whatever the vernacular is, some oldies. So it's pretty clear from the evidence that he's identifying the entire party as members of the oldies gang. And it doesn't mean that they have to be members of the oldies gang. It doesn't even mean that that's necessarily the motive, but it's clear that he's identified four individuals, and that afterwards, after they leave the bar, he follows those, he and his party, Mr. Lopez and his party, follow those same four individuals out of the bar, and they follow them in their two cars. So there's no question who the targets are, if you buy the prosecution's theory as to what the motive, what the intent was here.
Counsel, and given that Mr. Lopez was the driver, why couldn't the jury draw an inference or draw a conclusion that, since he's the driver, by driving and shooting at the same time, he's effectively putting a whole bunch of people at risk, regardless of whether he has a target or four targets, mm-hmm. that he is, putting people at risk and thus meeting the elements of extreme indifference murder?
Well, there's no evidence that he's putting anyone in risk other than the occupants of those two vehicles. What the evidence shows, and I think this might address your question directly, and don't take my word for it, I'm talking the prosecutor's own words, is the car is traveling at no faster than a walking pace when the shots are fired. And he fires two to three shots when I say he, I mean whoever the shooter is, because it's clearly disputed who the shooter is. I think there's evidence that maybe it's Vargas. I think defense might suggest that maybe it's Segura. There's only, I think, one witness who's Segura, who says that Mr. Lopez fired some of the shots. And I think the defense maintained that he didn't know any shooting was happening. He didn't fire any of the shots. But it's at no further than a walking pace. And if there are people who are put at risk, if they're innocent bystanders, so to speak, then it's certainly incumbent upon the prosecution to produce the goods, to produce that evidence. And they don't. And in fact, not only do they not do it, they, in their summation of the evidence, they show that there are in fact no one around. The prosecutor himself says that there are no witnesses around, there are no people in the area. There's no traffic in the area. There's testimony, there's no traffic in the area. No one is in that area other than these four identified, apparently or allegedly, targeted individuals.
Counsel, let's just test the boundaries of your theory a little bit. What if those four individuals and one other person got in the car with them? Then what? Then is it extreme indifference? Because he didn't see that one other person in the bar? Is it just because he saw them in the bar that takes away the universal malice?
If there are people who are not targeted, then who are in or near the area, but these are people that aren't at least peripherally involved in whatever is going on here, whether it be a drug deal, whether it be a dispute, whatever. I think what I might suggest, I don't know if this will answer your question or not, but if you look at Candelaria, for example, in the facts of Candelaria, the targeted individual is a PM, and they don't know who, when they encounter his car, they don't know who, if his grandmother's in the car with him, who is in the car with him. There are people around, and then 26 shots are fired in the area of his car. So that's the kind of circumstance where a defendant shoots, not knowing or caring who the victim may be. So I think that's sort of the distinction here, that type of thing. And then, as I mentioned in the briefs as well, there's a very close connection here. These four individuals are followed out of the bar. They're not, no one loses sight of them. They don't stop to pick anybody up. Whatever happens at this corner, at this street corner, happens without any interruption in time, whether it's a drug deal gone bad or whether it's a gang-related shooting or what have you.
Again, I mean, I understand that your theory is that all four of them were being targeted, but why couldn't the jury believe the prosecution's theory that it was actually Mr. Escal that was being targeted, since he's the only one that had some sort of direct contact inside mm-hmm. of the facility with the defendant? And could they just as equally infer that, yeah, I mean, he's with these other folks, but they're actually going after him, and whether or not they succeed in shooting him, you know, the other folks are being put at extreme risk of being targeted.
Sure. Let me just back up for just one moment and point out that that is not the prosecution's theory. That is the theory that the people trotted out for the first time on appeal. But I think that to directly answer your question, Judge Fox, we know that a jury verdict cannot be based on speculation and cannot be based on conjecture. And there's simply no evidence of that whatsoever. There's no evidence that the circumstances of this crime are that those four individuals are not targeted. And we know that because these shots are fired from very close range, 2-3 feet, at a very slow pace, and into both cars, and at least possibly four shots, one for each person, possibly six shots. I'm not sure. There's some dispute about the physical evidence, whether there was more than that. But it can't be. First off, the back car, I think the killing act itself, of course, would pertain only to the cars that the shots that are fired in Mr. Escobar's car. That's the killing act. And the circumstances there just simply don't suggest that anyone other than at least the two occupants of Mr. Escobar's car would be put at risk.
Mr. Jacob, just out of curiosity.
Yes.
What were the proper charges here? First degree murder and 3 attempted first degree murder?
Well, of course, nothing was charged with respect to the other 3 people. And that's a prosecutorial decision. I don't know why that decision was made, but that's what happened below. The charges that were leveled here were first-degree murder after deliberation, which the jury acquitted Mr. Lopez of, first-degree extreme indifference murder, and accessory, and that has to do with the driving away from the scene of the crime with, you know, possibly with a shooter, probably with a shooter in the car. So those are the 3 charges. There were no charges leveled with respect to the other 3 people involved.
Yeah, I'm thinking hypothetically how the prosecutor would have charged this.
Right, it certainly could have been charged differently. I understand what the state is arguing on appeal, and I understand what Judge Fox is getting at, but I think it's just so very telling that you look at the prosecutor's opening statement, and there is no theory whatsoever of extreme indifference murder there. This is a case where I think the defense would have been quite correct in just moving for a judgment of acquittal, at least as to that charge, after opening statement, because there is, I have scoured it, I have read it, I have reread it again last night. Again, there is nothing there, nor is there anything suggesting extreme indifference murder in his opening, closing argument. And the only thing that the prosecutor has to say about extreme indifference murder is a brief reference in his rebuttal closing argument. And that act that he alleges constitutes extreme indifference murder isn't even the same act that the state is alleging on appeal. The act that he is saying is, well, when they were driving away and being chased by the charger, a shot was fired, and Mr. Durand was never even heard the initial encounter, who's a neighbor in the area, came out and saw and heard one shot fired from the car that Mr. Lopez was in at that time. And that's clearly not the killing act here. As expected, we're not going to reach the second issue, and I'd like to save whatever time I've left for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Chamberlain.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Warbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. With regard regard to sufficiency of the evidence, I think that the first important point to remember is that it is always evaluated in the light most favorable to the prosecution, because I think a good number of the defense arguments are framed in the light of the evidence most favorable to the defense here. It's important that that is not standard. It's both what is most favorable to the prosecution, and it's also the question of, after viewing the evidence in light of the most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond reasonable doubt. So when we are assessing the evidence which supports a jury's verdict, we are necessarily always doing so at this point in hindsight. And in doing so, in deciding whether any rational trier of fact could find these elements, I think that the prosecution's arguments to the jury are in fact irrelevant to a sufficiency analysis, because of course the arguments of counsel are not evidence. Certainly for that reason, there's no way the defense could move for judgment of acquittal after opening statement, because there has been no evidence submitted at that point in time. That is simply what the prosecutor believes that the evidence in the case might show. Similarly, I think it doesn't make a difference whether the arguments I present to you today and in the briefs are the same arguments that were made by the prosecutor to the trial court. Again, we're looking at hindsight to see if any rational trier of fact could find the elements in order to return a guilty verdict. I do agree with Mr. Jekyll that the question is whether, in fact, there is universal malice in this case, whether the defendant acted without knowing or caring who his victims would be. And I think that it's probably most useful to look at the Candelaria case, because in that case, there were shots fired into a car. There were four individuals in the car. One of the individuals had been targeted by the shooter. That was not the individual who died in that case, but in fact, there was a universal malice verdict returned, which was in fact supported by the evidence, according to the Supreme Court.
Ms. Rohrbarton, do you believe that that fact, the fact that a different individual than the one that was targeted was the one that was killed, does that somehow make Candelaria inapplicable here, or does that affect the analysis?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't affect the analysis. What was important in Candelaria was that the Supreme Court clarified that you could find both after deliberation murder towards a targeted individual, but you could also have extreme indifference murder even affecting the same individual. So I don't think it's important that it was a passenger who was not the targeted individual in that car who died. And I think that it's wrong to describe the other three individuals in the car here besides the victim as targeted individuals. That may be true looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense, but it is not true looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, because as I've laid out clearly, and this court is aware, the contact in the bar was between the defendant and the victim. The victim had apparently on his between his thumb and forefinger a very prominent tattoo associating himself with the Oldies gang. He apparently was no longer active in that gang, but he had a very visible sign relating to the Oldies gang. And the defendant flashed his own gang symbol by means of lifting up his shirt, his allegiance with the NSM, or the Northside Mafia. The other individuals who were with the victim, there was absolutely no evidence they were associated with gangs. More importantly, they had no visible indications that they were gang members, unlike the victim in this case. So I think under Candelaria, what this court can conclude in looking at the jury's verdicts is that a reasonable jury could conclude that in fact the targeted individual was the victim, and there was extreme indifference in the killing act, the spraying the car with bullets. And spraying a car with bullets is a classic indication of an extreme indifference. Another case that I've pointed out in the brief, Rubio, is a situation where the car that was sprayed with bullets actually had no people in it, but it was nonetheless still attempted extreme indifference murder because of the universal malice, the extreme indifference to the value of human life generally. I'm not sure that I have other comments on this issue. I think it's fairly well laid forth in the brief. And as I said, I think that the important thing is that we look at the light most favorable to the prosecution and whether any rational trier of fact could reach this conclusion based on the evidence that was presented. Does this court have other questions?
Just one last question. If I'm understanding the defense argument correctly, they're basically saying all four people were targeted. And if all four people were targeted and one of the targets is killed, why couldn't the jury find just straight up murder one rather than an extreme indifference theory?
Well, certainly in this case, the defendant was charged with both active deliberation murder and extreme indifference murder. And I think it's also true that the prosecutor's arguments made to the jury at trial were asking the jury to convict of active deliberation murder. But I think when we are looking at the sufficiency of the evidence for extreme indifference murder, it's immaterial that there was an acquittal on active deliberation murder. I think what's important is that the evidence supports that there was a targeted individual who was the driver, the victim, and that the other three individuals were those to which we have an absolute extreme indifference.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, I thank this court for its attention, and I'd ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Rokoff. Mr. Jagel, you have about a minute.
So I want to return to something that Judge Fox asked earlier and that the state alluded to. Whether these other three people are or are not gang members is entirely irrelevant to this determination. I mean, I think the case that you could look at in that regard is Atkins. In Atkins, a man walking down the street, he wants to kill a Crip. He asks the person he passes, "Are you a Crip?" Before the man even answers, he shoots him. Atkins is mentioned in Candelaria, as it were, in a footnote by Justice Coates, where he says that there is every reason to believe that from its recitation of that evidence, demonstrating an intentional murder of a competing gang member, that there may not have been sufficient evidence to support a finding of extreme indifference in that case. And I think that's the same situation here. Whether or not the evidence is stronger that Mr. Escobal is a member of the Oldies, the others are only his associates, or something that is irrelevant to this determination, it's quite clear that those four people are targeted. And it certainly does matter what the prosecutor said in closing argument. And I say that those cases I see by the time in the brief.
Thank you, Mr. Jagel. And thank you, Mr. Rubov. Thanks to both counsel for your superb arguments this afternoon. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.